All right, guys, welcome back to another episode of the Beyond the Trek podcast. Today we have a really special guest. I've been excited for this episode for a long time. A close mentor and friend of mine who I've got to know over the past year and a half, JC Glick. And without further ado, I'm going to give him a little introduction too, and then kind of let him take the floor from there. So JC, we're honored to have you, brother. JC Glick is a true warrior, leader, and innovator in both the military and corporate worlds. JC is a retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel. He spent over 20 years serving at the highest levels of special operations with multiple combat deployments around the globe. His experience leading elite teams in some of the most challenging environments has shaped his groundbreaking approach to leadership, resilience, and performance. After retiring from the military, JC transitioned to the private sector, where he's continued to lead and inspire. He's the author of A Light in the Darkness, Leadership Development for the Unknown, as well as Meditations of an Army Ranger, and has worked with NFL teams, Fortune 500 companies, and educational institutions to help them unlock the full potential of their people. And currently, JC is serving as the CEO of the Commit Foundation, a nonprofit dedicated to helping veterans and their families navigate career transitions with purpose and success. His work continues to bridge the gap between high performance leadership in the military and thriving in the civilian world. JC brings a rare blend of battle-tested wisdom, deep emotional intelligence, and forward-thinking leadership principles. And today, he's here to share some of that insight with us. So please welcome to the show, JC.
Wow, thank you. That may be the best introduction I've ever had. Thank you. it's funny when you hear the highlights, you know, you forget all the kind of the low levels, and there were more low levels and all the hard work that goes into that. But that was really kind. Thank you.
Absolutely, brother. I'm humbled to have you here. And I use this same quote whenever we got to talk to Bill Austin a little while ago. I'm always humbled in the presence of warriors, and that's exactly how I feel right now. And we'll talk about it as well with your organization. But the stuff you're doing at Commit is amazing. I've had multiple friends, peers, who I've referred into the program. I know DeAndre, one of our teammates, he told me about it and got me involved. And, you know, just like Megan was my counselor, and, you know, awesome. In a time when I really needed you guys, and, you know, nobody else would really took a chance on me based on my situation. You know, like, they're like, you know, if you're getting out honorably, if it's an honorable, we can help you. But, you know, you guys looked right past that and were able to see me, you know, as a human, and, you know, somebody who's trying to better themselves and, you know, wants to live with purpose and, you know, kind of continue that outside of just what they did in the military. So extremely grateful for that. And it's an awesome organization.
Well, thank you. It's an awesome organization. And, you know, I think we'd like to say that we look at the whole person. Right. And you know, as you and I were just saying, we look at the actor, not the action. And, you know, we also look at, you know, a lot of what we do at Commit is looking at the future, not looking at the past. And when we look at the past, it's to see how that can shape the future. And if we say, you know, a single act from a great actor destroys a potential, then I'm not really sure. You know, I mean, that's the same in leadership, right? I mean, if every time somebody makes a mistake, they're dead to us, or they're not, or we're done with them, then everybody's got to be perfect all the time, and nobody's perfect all the time. And where does all the learning come from? It can't come from a book or just stories. Sometimes you experience the learning, right? I mean, a great world is if we could get iteratively better through other people's experiences, that would be wonderful. And we would progress a whole lot farther as a human species. But that's just not how we work. And we don't think of the nuance that happens. You know, we see an act and we don't look at all the other factors that are involved. Megan and I were just talking about this today, as a matter of fact, is you can't look at you have to look at an action in isolation, but you have to understand the action's context too. Because sometimes we make a decision in context that sometimes seems like not even a bad decision. And it's only hindsight that allows us to go, oh, geez, you know, this was wrong, or I thought this was this. And, you know, and then there's the human aspect where we have to understand, like, there's an internal piece to who we are. And it's, you know, that doesn't necessarily define us. It's sometimes, you know, what we have to tamp down, that internal instinctual piece. And sometimes it overpowers us, right? I talk a lot. I get a good friend who talks about your inner ape is the only thing that you can control, right? Your attitude, preparation, and effort. And I pushed back with him and I said, look, yes, and I can control my attitude after a certain amount of time, right? If somebody hits me in the face, like sometimes I get, like the immediate thing is I'm angry and it takes me a second to go, okay, wait, what's going on? Right. And sometimes that's good. Sometimes maybe you just want to be angry, but like I control my attitude after a period of time. Hopefully it's short. Sometimes it's long. My preparation, I never know if my preparation is enough until after the event has happened. Right. So yeah, I can control my preparation, but I don't know if it's enough. And then again, the same thing with effort. I've consistently been surprised at, you know, even when I think I'm done, I'm really not done. That was my mind telling me I'm done. So my argument is, and people don't like when I say this, but, you know, we don't control much in our lives. And I think accepting that and then being able to understand those factors that are uncontrollable and then trying to figure out how do I make sure that the flash to bang on controlling attitude is faster? And how do I prepare enough so that, you know, so I can see what the thing I'm trying to accomplish is? And then, you know, how do I ensure that I'm continuing to push even when I think I'm done?
Yeah, that's very true. And, you know, I love that ape mentality too. That's the first time I ever heard that, but a lot of wisdom there for sure. I feel like these are all things that are forged in the fire. And you don't really know what it takes until it happens. You just hope that you're prepared and what you've done, you know, leading up to that. I know that, we have an event coming up, working with 27th Response, based out of Georgia for, we're doing a course at the end of June, for first responders but really anyone. And it's like our role in that as Beyond the Trek is we're kind of, you know, what happens if this event happens, what if active shooter or whatever it is, if you're, you know, a first responder and you're faced with, you know, something very traumatic, you know, what are the actions to prepare yourself beforehand? And how do you deal with that afterwards too?
Right.
Cause that's something that's very hard to prepare for. And it's like when you're faced with that, I mean, you don't know. And again, back to what you said too, is like when we do go through whatever it is, it's trials and tribulations or, you know, the ups and downs, you know, it's really important to, you can either bottle that in or hold it to yourself. But if you do that, and even if you work through it and you get on the other end of it and, you know, you become successful from it, it's, if you're not sharing that with others, what's really the point? You know, I love something that our founder Chad says is, you know, it's literally in a name, Beyond the Trek. Like, who are you after? You know, whether it's success or failure, whatever it is, it's, you're not defined by whatever that is, by those successes or failures, but it's what you do beyond that. What is your legacy beyond that? And who can you affect? It's because there's someone out there living your story. Chances are it's a huge world, you know, however many billions of people. And the fact of the matter is there's someone out there living your story that could probably benefit from hearing how you navigated it and the challenges that you faced.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's important. And it doesn't even have to be, you know, they're living their story, but there are going to be similarities. There are going to be experiences that are human experiences that we all see and we all go through. And, you know, everybody always looks for their North Star, right? And I go, man, we're not finite like that. We're not so pinpoint. I argue that we should be looking at a constellation, right? There's a piece from this person's journey that makes sense. And there's a piece from this person's journey that makes sense because my journey is going to be slightly different than theirs. And theirs is going to be slightly different from someone else's. And making sure that I can see that constellation and navigate my path through not a North Star, but a constellation. So this star at one time and this star at another time and this star at another time. And that's what's, you know, again, I think we, you know, we're humans. We try to make everything simple, right? We want to make sense of the world. So we box it and we say things like, oh, well, find your North Star. Dude, that's like, man, that's as hard as like find your purpose, right? I mean, that's like, it's so singularity in nature. And as humans, we're not singular. We're multifaceted and multidimensional. And there's going to be pieces from there's people that I have absolutely nothing in common with, except for this one experience that they had. And that one experience I can transfer over into my life and use it for good. And I think that's why, you know, there's plenty of pitfalls to narrative, but I think understanding the narrative in context is important.
No, absolutely. And it's very true. And yeah, like the North Star thing, it is tough because a lot of times that can change too, you know, and depending on your season of life. One thing I like to, that I heard from actually is one of my pastors had told me, it was like, it's good to have goals. It's good to, you know, have these aspirations, but you got to have it with an open hand because, you know, things can change. A storm can knock the ship off course. Sometimes it might still reach the destination. It still might reach that destination. It's heading towards there, but there's going to be things that throw it off and, you know, you're going to have to reroute and kind of, you know, course correct a little bit. And yeah, you're right. It's everybody's human experience is a human experience because it's in the name. It's human. So right. Not everything's going to be the same. But if somebody can take a tidbit from your story or something here or there from someone else and find some inspiration or motivation behind it to help them along or something they haven't thought about, it can make a lot of difference.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, brother, there's a lot to go into for sure. But I guess just to kind of give the audience, you know, kind of a little bit of background, just wanted to hear about your upbringing and kind of what led you to, you know, to the path that you chose in life.
Not the best childhood, for a host of reasons. But I will tell you that, you know, and again, this is so funny. I always think serendipity, it's serendipity is something that we're always trying to find and at Commit, I think we create serendipity, but it's so funny. I was just talking to my parents about this. I just saw them last week. And, you know, I look at decisive points in my life. And the first decisive point was, you know, I'd been homeless and on my own. And, if I was a rich kid, people would have said I took a gap year. I wasn't a rich kid, so I just didn't go to college because I couldn't get into any place that didn't just want my money. And I'd taken 2 years off, and I was going to join the Marine Corps. It was right before, I'm going to tell you how old I am. It was right before the first Gulf War, and I was going to join the Marine Corps so I could go to war. And not because of any philanthropic or higher purpose, but because I was just tired of not having a place to live and tired of being evicted and, you know, being homeless and not having any prospects. And, you know, I called my parents or called my dad and my stepmom who, you know, I called my mom and they took me in. And that was the first decisive point in my life. And I think it was a change in trajectory for me. Was able to go to college. And what made me decide to live the life or start the life was I felt that I could only do that in the United States of America. And I still feel pretty strongly about that. I think that this country gives an opportunity that certainly can be wasted, but if seized, can do some great things for you. And that's why I joined, and then when I got in, I really just wanted to continue to surround myself. I didn't feel so good about who I was. And I thought that if I was with great people, I would become better. And some of it was reflected glory, right? Like if I'm with the best guys, maybe that makes me a better guy.
We talked about that a little bit too, before we started recording as well. I'm sure we'll get into it.
But I'll tell you, what I learned, and I learned it from every single person I served with, is how great they were. And I wanted to emulate them. Right. And then I stayed in, because of the people that were just amazing. And they were doing incredibly difficult things. And they were making it look easy, and they were just such good humans, and they were selfless, and they were thinking about others and how to make sure their teammates were better. And, I look at the NCOs that taught me so much and how amazing they were as leaders, right? They didn't just lead down, they led laterally, and they led up, and they did it flawlessly. And just to be surrounded by them was, that's why I stayed. I think that I read somewhere once, and I don't remember who wrote it, but like it was a guy who went into the airborne, and he said, I didn't want to be airborne, but I wanted to be around guys who liked to jump out of airplanes. I didn't like jumping out of airplanes, but I like to be around guys who jumped out of airplanes. And I did like all the stuff we did, but I like doing it with those people. And that's why I stayed in. And, as I reflect, I have zero regrets in my life. I do reflect a lot. I don't think regret buys you anything. I think reflection is what's important, because that's the way you learn. And as I reflect, I wish I had fully taken advantage of the incredible people that I knew. I think I was so worried about, am I good enough, and trying to prove that I was good enough, that maybe I didn't take kind of a more studious approach of how much can I learn from everybody. And that's something that I reflect on frequently, to be honest with you. But that's why I did 20 years. And look, to get paid to do the stuff that we were doing is pretty cool, right? I mean, it's certainly an opportunity. It's a once in a lifetime opportunity that, I think was amazing.
No, 100%. And I'm sure it's tough too, because like you said, you get to do some pretty incredible stuff that a lot of people, haven't been exposed to or got to do. And when you leave that, because there's a great Moneyball. You've seen the movie Moneyball.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sure. I love that. And you probably know the quote. He's talking to one of the guys that they're trying to sign. He's like, or I think it was, he was talking about his own life. And he's like, everybody's told, it's when it's time to stop playing the young man's game. Some of us are told at 18, some of us are told at 40, but we're all told. And I think that movie is a kind of a great testament of that, like him kind of navigating a transition from this identity that he had to now, he's in a new role. He's kind of like, building the future. It's another thing too. It's funny. You talked about joining the Marines. It seems like everybody, their first impression of the military, they always want to be a Marine or something. It's a trend that I've noticed. It just seems funny. I don't know what it is about the Marines.
They literally have the best uniforms, and I think that's they have the best commercials.
That's true.
I will never forget that I went and watched a Marine Corps graduation once, and I was, you know, in 05 at the time, and I was struck because, you know, you and I graduated Ranger School. I pinned my Ranger tab and I was like, I just need to go get something to eat. Like, there was no emotion other than relief and let's go, let's get out of here and let's go to work. I watched these young kids who, and arguably it's, you know, basic training is basic training, and that's tough wherever you get a basic training. And then they do the crucible and they have, but I would argue their basic training is no more difficult than anybody else's, but at the end of the crucible, they get the Eagle Globe and Anchor, something that every single Marine wears. And there wasn't one kid who wasn't crying. They were all in tears for getting this, you know, less than 1% of the DOD has a Ranger tab. Every Marine has this Eagle Globe and Anchor, and they were moved. And I went, okay, they're doing something right. I mean, the indoctrination that occurs in Marine Corps basic training is incredible, that they get that they elicit this moving experience for these young men and women for a piece of metal. It's unbelievable.
No, it really is. And it's, you know, it's something that I've heard you speak on before, is that's like a sense of tribe. You know, it's you're building a tribe, and it's a sense of belonging, which is something that the military is really good at. I mean, part of the reason why I'm here, and, you know, Chad, you know, getting introduced to him when I was going through the, you know, the basic officer leader course at Fort Benning, you know, kind of getting to know him and kind of starting that relationship with him. And just, you know, we're very like-minded on a lot of things. And he's been a huge mentor for me. You also talked about that, you know, just some of the non-commissioned officers you were able to work with. And it was the people that you wanted to stay in for. It's, and, you know, didn't want to jump out of, you know, didn't really want to jump out of airplanes, but liked being with the people that jumped out of airplanes, you know, the peer pressure and things like that come with. Yeah. Sometimes peer pressure is a good thing, but just the importance of mentorship. It's surrounding yourself with people who, you know, people who are better than you. If you surround yourself with people who, you know, are on your level, or it can sometimes be harder to, you know, you're not getting pushed in a direction where, you know, to get you out of your comfort zone. And just, there's so much to go into with that, and just the importance of mentorship, you know, having you as a mentor over, you know, the last year and a half, and just getting to pick your brain on things and just gaining a new perspective. Cause I feel like so much of life is perspective, you know, good and bad. You can take perspective from everything. And, you know, it's something to be very thankful for, is the perspective that you gain throughout, you know, anything that you're exposed to in life, and just kind of opens up to, you know, to just new ways of thinking that you hadn't previously thought before.
Well, I think, look, you opened up a couple of different things that I think are important. Let's start with perspective. And perspective is essential, right? And here's what we have to understand. And there's going to be people who disagree with me. I mean, there's people in the academic community that argue about this all the time. I do not believe in one objective reality except your own. The only reality that is truly objective is your lived experience. But your lived experience to me is completely subjective, okay? Because I haven't lived it. The only objective experience that I understand is my own objective experience, my own objective perception. And I recognize that my objective perspective is subjective to everyone else. Now, what we do as humans is, you know, through conversation, through shared environments, through similar experiences, we go, oh, that makes sense to me. And I will move something that is subjective over into objective for me. Or I will even say, okay, I will see that as objective, even though I don't know anything about it. I trust this person's perspective, that I will make this objective. And really getting along with people is being able to balance their objective with your objective, right? When we have friction with people, it's because objectively we don't see things the same way. And then we're surprised because it's real to us. Well, it's real to us for, through a whole series of things. But where that comes in, where that becomes important in mentorship, and I've actually written about this, because I think it's imperative for anyone who's trans. You know, when I talk to athletes, it's the same advice I give to veterans and service members and spouses, is you need kind of three groups of mentors. Your first group of mentors are the people who kind of look like you and were like you, but then became really successful. So for me, it's those people that were in the military, had, you know, experienced some of the same things, but then succeeded on the outside. Okay. That's one type of mentors I have. Then I have this other group of mentors. They've never, ever been in the military. They have no idea what the military is like, but they've been really successful in the world. I need their perspective. They have a perspective that, you know, is completely foreign to anybody who's been in the military, because they've grown up thinking a different way. And that's a group of mentors that I have. And then this third group, and this is really important. I have a group of mentors who are all younger than me. And they're maybe, you know, starting out or mid-career. And I grab those because, and it's certainly all mentorship relationships are symbiotic, but this one maybe a little bit more, because I certainly would like to think that I'm able to mentor them. But what we forget is, in sports and in the military, every year you're getting driven physically, mentally, emotionally, you know, societally, by a younger generation. It's just that's how the system works. And all those challenges are being hey, well, now this is a new thing. Okay, well, how do I understand that? How does that, right? So you become very aware of what's going on in the world. I get out, and like 5 years after I get out, I looked around me, and it was a bunch of middle-aged white guys who I was talking to. And I'm like, well, this is no good, because we all think the same, even if we're like, we have similar experiences, or, you know, how diverse could the thoughts be? So I really started to focus on, who's this younger group of folks who are thinking about the world in a different way? They're processing it differently. They're, you know, when I write an article, they're like, I will send a lot of my articles to a younger person to say, how does this land with you? What does this mean to you? What are you thinking about when you read this? I've literally changed some of my writings because, like, they were like, I don't get it. Like, this doesn't mean anything to me. Okay, well, that's no good. Okay, so how are you looking at this? And it's changed my perspective as well. So I think that having those group of mentors, that really, the other piece that you've got to do in all three of those groups is, how did I connect with them, and where do I cross over with them? Do I cross over them in the academic world, in my social world, in my work world? Like, where is it that that these linkages are? Because I want them spread out across everything so that I can, so they get a more holistic perspective that they provide.
No, that is, that's very interesting too. And I think that third group that you talked about, that's one that's probably tough for a lot of people. And the two words that jump out to me are humility and empathy, with that, because you're talking to some people that they haven't had the life experience you've had, they're younger. And it's like, most of the time, where my mindset would go is like, why would I talk to them? They haven't even lived life. Like, you know, how would I talk to some, you know, young kid or something, that somebody just got out of college or something, like they haven't even went out and lived life. But you don't know somebody's experience and kind of, you know, their upbringing and the different things that they've went through, that they have a completely different mindset on, you know, just that's different from yours, that you can't relate to. Which requires you to humble yourself. It humbles you. And then, you know, you're able to be like, okay, you know, I see, it helps you see, you will never fully be able to know, because like we've talked about, you haven't lived what they've lived. You know, it's very, you know, subjective, but you know, you're only responsible for your experiences, and you can talk on that, but it helps kind of provide a little bit of clarity is something that I've found is like kind of why people, you know, think the way they do, or maybe how they go about things that might be completely different from you. A lot of that is, you know, their own, it's a completely different, you know, diverse background or something that you're not, until you get yourself out there and you have these conversations with people, and even going as far as like from a mentorship perspective, like being able to humble yourself and be like, yeah, I have this whole group that's younger than me, but they are, you know, they have their own talents and abilities and perspective that I wouldn't otherwise get somewhere else.
Yeah. And I think we look at humility wrong. Look, I think that if you talk to anybody who knew me all the way up through captain, they would say humility is not something that was in my vocabulary. But I think we look at humility from a Christian Judeo perspective of, oh, I'm not good at that. And I think that's actually, I think that's damaging. I think it's okay to admit like, hey, I'm good at this. Like, I think there's a feeling that comes with that, that I think is important. But when we think of humility now, I think we have to recognize, and I have this, so one of my younger mentors, a guy named John Schwartz, he gave me a saying that I use literally every day. Everything we know now is wrong. And that's the truth, right? I mean, whatever we know today, it's probably wrong, right? Less than 6 months ago, we thought the fastest that anything could go is the speed of light. And a bunch of scientists moved an atom faster than the speed of light. Okay, so that was wrong, right? A, time and space can't be changed. Well, that changes. Oh, the universe made out of dark matter. Well, maybe not, right? Everything we know now is wrong. And if you go into life saying that, you're much more open to, wait, maybe that's right. And it requires some investigation and it requires some thought. But I think that humility of, hey, what I know now, it may not be right tomorrow. So, you know, how do I go into a conversation? How do I go into a thought exercise? How do I engage with other people so that, okay, I have a perspective. I'm not sure I'm right. And I think that's the humility that we have to get, you know, as humans. It's essential for leaders. But I think for a better humanity, like, you know, and the ability to understand there's a humility in that two things can be true at the same time. Right. And that we hate that as humans. Like, we don't like that two things can be true at the same time.
It has to be black or white.
A and B, right. And quite honestly, I think we have to be really comfortable with that. Right. I mean, I look at our polarization in politics. I look at our conversation societally. It tends to be very a false binary choice that you have to make. And I'm like, wait, they both can be true. Now, if we accept that they're both true, how do we move forward together instead of saying somebody's wrong? How do we move forward together and say, okay, some of your needs are being met and some of my needs are being met?
No, yeah, we tend to look, and I think, you know, it's true for a lot of people, especially like in leadership roles in the military. There's, you know, everything has to be black and white, you know, but there's stuff in the gray sometimes. You know, you've dealt with you know, the answer might be in the gray sometimes. It's not, it seems like there's the by the book things that are the black and white that we have to go by. But a lot of times you have to delve into that gray, and, you know, you get that through, you know, you can't just be the guy up there, you know, everything I say is the right answer. It requires you to take that back seat kind of and be able to not be offended by, you know, somebody challenging that too.
And I wonder, you know, and I don't know the answer to this, is if it's black and white and you tell somebody to do something that's clearly in the reg or in the, is that really leadership or is that managing? Yeah, right. I mean, I can enforce anything that's written down. I don't know that that's leadership, what I've got to do is I've got to convince you that what I'm asking you to do is right. And even if I don't know that it's right, it's the right thing to do in the moment. And I think that's, you know, that takes leadership. I think enforcing a black and white what's in the policy, if that's all it was to it, I don't think it's that hard to lead. Right. I mean, we get all these manuals. Well, if I do everything like it says in the manual, you don't need me to think. You just need me to memorize the manual. But what you want me to do, and I mean, there's all sorts of famous quotes about the American Army never follows its own manuals. Well, that's because we believe in a thinking warrior. Like, we can only write about what the organization has experienced. We can't write about things that you're going through right now because it looks different. I talk about a story in Haiti where, you know, we were in Haiti. It was like my first deployment. And Haitians were stealing wire from right in front of us, like right in front of the compound. They were trying to take our concertina wire. There wasn't anything like, hey, here's the rules of force for that, or here's what you do in that situation. I need some private to make a good decision on how do you respond to this guy who's, you know, he's not supposed to do that. There's nothing written about it. It doesn't really, the rules of force don't apply. So what do you do? And I think that that's something that, you know, that's why we need good leaders.
100% true. Something too, you know, on a little bit off, you know, moving on from this topic is, talking, and we've talked about it a lot recently, especially on our platform. If you've seen, you know, some of our episodes is strength and vulnerability. And I've seen a few different, you know, talks that you've had talking about this and how important it is today, especially to be a good leader. And, you know, I don't think, you know, probably managers are probably not, they don't have to be very vulnerable. But just kind of speaking on that from your perspective and, you know, how vulnerability is a strength. It's not something that to be looked at as a weakness for us.
Yeah. I think, you know, nobody's probably ever seen it, but, I did a commercial for GNC. They were doing a product called Unbreakable with Jay Glazer. I don't know, maybe the people who followed me on Instagram have seen it. I don't know that anybody else. It's still on YouTube, the commercial. And I actually say that vulnerability is actually a superpower. Okay. When we get to a point where we can say, I screwed this up, or, hey, I feel this way, or, and not in a victimization kind of like, well, what you said makes me feel bad, but, hey, I feel bad. And I want to talk about those feelings, or I'm confused, or geez, I don't know. When we get to that point in our human experience, I think that we've really reached a different level, because it allows for a more open conversation. It allows for trust to flow both ways. And you know, I think it's, you know, I don't even know that I look at it as vulnerability. I think that if I can, if I'm to reflect on it, I say, yeah, okay, I'm being vulnerable. But, you know, I talk about my suicide attempts. I talk about, you know, a failed marriage. I talk about where I've screwed up as a parent. I've talked about where I've screwed up as a leader. And I think, you know, there's tremendous strength in that. In that I'm willing to take accountability for my actions and not, you know, like, oh, well, my marriage failed because so-and-so was this and so-and-so was, no, it was like, I can't control what they did and it's not important. What is important is here are the actions in context that I took that as I reflect on them, I think there was a better way to go. And I think that being open and vulnerable, it's this, you know, Mike Osterlink and I run this program for men. We got another one starting here in like a week. And it's called Resiliency 2.0, Resiliency Optimized. And it's really about, I think we get a lot of the David Goggins, Jocko Willick, you know, beat your chest, be a level 7 berserker. And that's great. I think that is part, like, terrific. Go run a bunch of ultra marathons, whatever. That's cool. And there's another piece of resiliency, which is opening up to somebody who matters to you and saying, hey, I don't think I'm meeting my requirements as a husband, as a father, as a teammate. Like, how can I do better? Right. There's rest. There's like, you know what? I don't feel like waking up at 4:30 in the morning and working out right now. I'm going to go to sleep and I'm going to sleep in another hour because that's okay. And sometimes rest is, you know, reset is resiliency, right? Saying like, oh, I screwed that up. And instead of hitting it hard again, like, all right, I'm going to go back and do it again. Where's that holding space for, hold on, why wasn't I successful? Let's look at all these little pieces, because there's no prize at the end of the day for continuing to hit your head against a brick wall. The idea is that you're figuring out, okay, how do I reduce the wall? Like, what's another way? And that's resiliency to me. It's how do I bounce back? How do I deal with those softer things? Because running an ultra marathon might make me physically and mentally tough. And I don't know that it makes me tough with my wife. I don't think she cares if I run an ultra marathon. In fact, she probably doesn't, because for the next 3 days, I'll be like, you know, in the ice bath and
she might be
around.
Taking care of you then.
Right.
Yeah. So it's going to make it harder for her.
So I think we have to see resiliency not as this chest pounding, you know, rah-rah kind of thing. And I think we have to look at it as how do I show up? How do I continue to show up? And how do I show up when I'm afraid or I'm sad and it's really tough for leaders. I always tell leaders, like, hey, if you're a good leader, you don't get to have any more bad days. So how do you have a bad day and not bring it to work and bring it to your people? And, you know, how do you deal without compartmentalizing, but how do you deal with the whole of being a human and still accomplish what you're trying to do?
Yeah. What you said, it just reminded me of that. And going back to talking about, you know, doing the hard things, everybody always, they always associate doing hard things with physical. It's always the ultra marathon or doing something like that or doing, you know, a selection type event. But sometimes doing something hard every day, which is one of our phrases, do something hard every day. You know, sometimes that's getting out of bed in the morning. Sometimes it's picking up the phone and calling a friend or a relative that you're pissed off at, or that somebody that wronged you, and, you know, looking past your own insecurities and, you know, showing some forgiveness, or, you know, just having a conversation with them. Cause personally, I think that's harder than anything physical that I've ever done, is when you're put in that position, you have to do something like that. You know, I put me out there to run that marathon. I know that, you know, I can knuckle drag my way through the finish line eventually, but, you know, when it comes to doing, you know, things like that, that makes me very uncomfortable, that can be tough. And it goes into a sense of fear. You know, we talk about facing and overcoming fear. And then, you know, a video that I just saw the other day was a pastor talking about this, and he was talking about living, are you living in a coffin or are you living in a classroom? And, you know, associating that with fear. Cause you know, living in fear, a lot of times it would put you in that coffin where, you know, you get yourself to a place that's almost unrecoverable. And you can bask in that and sit in it. And it will destroy you if you let it. But just kind of talking on fear a little bit and, you know, the different aspects of that and getting on the other side of it.
Yeah. I think, look, so most of the stuff that I think about with fear is grounded in, a guy named Tony Blauer and the Spear System. And he's got, you know, so many thoughts, but that's my grounding. And when we look at you know, fear as so many different aspects, you know, possible versus probable. We always worry about all the possible, right? My son Corbett just sent me an Instagram meme that said, you know, some study was done. I don't know if the study was done, but it was on Instagram. So I'm going to quote it.
But it's got to be true.
Got to be true. Like 83% of what we worry about never actually happens. And I see that as possible versus probable. Like Tony does this great exercise. If you think of all the things that could go wrong in a bar fight, you know, you'll come up with 500, they stab, shot, arrested, my family will leave me because I go to prison, da, 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 like all these horrible, horrible things. And if you looked at the list, the question would be, why would you ever go into the bar? And then you go down to, okay, what's probably going to happen? Well, some, you know, you'll get pushed around, you'll get jostled around, maybe you'll get sucker punched, you'll get tackled, but most of the time it gets broken up. Okay, well then, but we allow this possible to overcome us. You know, worst case, you know, it's funny, in the military, we always brief the most possible course of action and the most dangerous course of action. Most dangerous course of action is never, well, they drop a nuclear bomb on us. It's always like in the reality of what they have, what could possibly happen. And, but yet we get out and, or in our lives, we think about, oh, when I tell my wife that she's going to leave me or she's going to, like, it's always this horrible thing. You know, one of my business partners, Jim Stagnita, you know, he talks about, you know, you come down for coffee in the morning and, you know, your wife always makes you a cup of coffee and says, good morning. And this morning she doesn't, like, she's doing other stuff and she doesn't even acknowledge that you're there. The first thing that goes through your head is, what did I do wrong? How did I piss her off? What's, you know, and if you just take that second and go, hey, I noticed that you didn't, like, I didn't have coffee and you didn't say good morning to me. Most of the time it's, oh, the kids or such and such. Like it's usually not you. I mean, it's usually something else. And we tell this ourselves, this story in our head, that's, it's always negative. The story in your head is always negative. It's never positive. You never go into the interview on, oh, I'm going to totally nail this and get this job. It's, oh my God, I'm not going to get the job, or, you know, whatever it is, it's always the worst possible thing that could come on. We never go, or, hey, this will go really well and I'll like the guy. And right. I mean, we go in with all these expectations and there's an argument for, well, don't have any expectations. That'd be great if we can do that. But I would just go as far as, hey, stop thinking all the expectations are bad. Like sometimes they're good. And if they're bad, then you deal with them. You know, I used to think internally, I used to think if I don't think all the bad stuff that happened, that could happen, then it'll definitely happen. So if I think about it, that gets rid of it. Well, that's stupid, right? That's an immature way of thinking about it. But I think fear, if you think about anything that you've ever not done that you wanted to do, it was fear that was holding you back. And it's in our DNA. It's in our physiology, right? We're always looking for that saber-toothed tiger that's going to leap out and kill us. And it's in us. And what we have to do is take it from kind of the amygdala where it lives and it keeps us alive and it's a good thing. And in many cases in the modern world, put it into the prefrontal cortex where we go, wait, what am I really afraid of? What could really happen here? What's possible? What's probable? And then when we start putting it into those kind of more formal thought processes, we get through that fear. I'll tell you the worst thing that I like, here's a fear that like, here's something I hate doing and I'm always afraid of doing it. Firing people. I hate firing people. It's the worst thing that I have to do as a leader. is tell people that. Now I've had other, you know, I've had coaches and mentors say like, oh, well, no, you're giving them an opportunity to do something else. And you're taking them from something that maybe isn't there. And I always go back to, yeah, but what if it's me? What if I'm just a bad leader for them? Like, what if I'm just not giving them what they need? What if the issue isn't them? It's me. So it's something that, you know, I struggle with and I despise doing.
No, that's it's funny you say that too, because that actually came up in, you know, in a recent job interview that I had, you know, And they talked about one of the reasons why they like hiring, you know, military officers in particular is like, you guys aren't afraid to have those hard conversations. And I was kind of like, you know, I felt like I was putting on kind of a facade, because fortunately I haven't had to deal with that a lot. I was pretty blessed to have be around great teams and great leaders throughout most of my time. And there's exceptions, but you know, I didn't really have to always delve into that. And if it did, I had a non-commissioned officer. It's an interesting way of looking at it, being like, well, what did I do? And, you know, there are things that happen where it's completely out of your control. You know, maybe this person, if they're just not showing up or something, but, you know, maybe there is something else behind that. Maybe there's a reason behind why they're not getting there on time that you're not able to look at because you're concerned about a bottom line or something else. You're worried about the black and white. Yep. And it's something that going into that gray area. But yeah, that's something I was like, oh, it's kind of a weakness for me, honestly, like to have, because I'm a pretty nice guy. I don't really enjoy doing that, but that is doing something hard. And it is definitely a, like, I would consider that a fear as well, as, you know, you're having a conversation that's, you know, could be a life altering thing that you're telling people. You know, I've experienced it as well. You know, with placing my whole purpose, you know, in the military and what I did, and then hearing like, oh, well, you know, the process will be relatively quick, about 120 days or something. And you'll be out. So you'll have a paycheck for a little while. And it kind of just hit me. It took a while to hit me. And I'm like, yeah, I'm getting fired from the military, essentially, from everything that I've ever known. And it's the same if you're, you know, having to do that, being on the other end of that, if you don't have that experience of knowing what that feels like. But no, that's a great point. And, you know, something that's very hard to do. And it goes into that doing something hard for sure.
Yeah. That's the hardest thing I have to do. And it, for some reason, it wasn't as hard in the military. Because you are bound by certain things, and there are certain things that, like, hey, I got it. You know, sometimes I felt, and maybe this is a bad way of looking at it, in some cases, when I had to remove you from the armed forces, it was something that was usually completely out of my control. Like, look, this decision, this is a policy that, like, we just don't do this.
It's over my head or something.
Yeah. But, you know, when people got fired out of the regiment or AWG, it was, they weren't like losing their livelihood. They were just leaving that place, and they were going to go do great things somewhere else. Now, as a civilian CEO, okay, this person's not going to have a job. Like, what about their family? What about their, like, oh my gosh. Like, I think a lot about the context of their lives. And yeah, that's the hardest thing I do is ask people to leave.
It brings up another thing to me. And I think it's I've had talks with my father about this as well. And I think to a certain extent, I think that it's a myth that when people say, oh, I don't care what people think about me, or ah, whatever, you know, we all to a certain extent do care what people think about us, because you don't want to be, or again, it goes into that fear, the most dangerous, most likely course of action, where, oh, this person thinks I'm a loser, or I'm a crook or something, or I did them dirty and I'm no good. I have no good in me because of maybe this one experience that they had. So just kind of like, you know, speaking to that myth of like, you know, oh, I don't care what people think about me, you know, and how that affects us.
Yeah, I do think, you know, the older you get, the more self-actualized you get, the less it impacts you. I'm not saying you don't care, but I think it impacts you a little less. I'll also tell you that there's two things that I remember. Is one, somebody else's opinion of me is none of my business, right? And that's an important thing, is like, that's none of my business. If they think I'm an idiot, it's none of my business. Like, that's on them. And the other piece is, I can't control it. All I can do, you might as well ask me, you know, well, how do you make someone love you? I don't know. Like all I can do is the things that I think will make this person love me. They get to choose whether they love me or not. And so all I can control are the things, doing the things that I think will get me to that outcome, right? Kind of attitude, preparation, effort kind of thing. I can do those things, but that person gets to decide what they think of me, how they feel about me. And I mean, we've all come in contact with somebody that we just meet like right away and we're like, oh, I don't like this guy, right? And it's not fair. It's not right. And sometimes we, you know, the older I've gotten, the more I fight that response. Like, okay, wait, hold on. That's the amygdala talking. There's something that triggered that. Where did it come from? Why did it, like, why am I not giving this person an opportunity? But I know people do it with me, and again, none of my business, and I can't control. All I can do is be me. And if you don't like me authentically, I think that's okay. Like, I get it, you know? And I know that there are people out there who think I'm a horrible son of a bitch. I hate that. It bothers me. And I can't do anything about it.
No, you're absolutely right. It's, you know, we're not entitled to other people's opinions. And something I definitely that I thought about, you know, you, like I explained in the introduction, I know you've led some incredible people. You've been, you know, in the military and the civilian world, you know, at the top echelons. But on top of all that, you're a father and a husband. And I saw recently that your daughter just got married, and congratulations. It looked like a beautiful wedding. And just kind of from your experience, like, how do you go about balancing all these things, being the best person you can at work, being performing at the highest level, but then also being able to pour into your spouse and then also being there for your kids, you know, in the capacity that, you know, we're called to be there.
Yeah. I think the question for me is, how often do I have to be great? And it's funny, 'cause I'll ask athletes this, I'll ask kids this. I'm like, how often do you have to be great? And everybody thinks it's like 90% or better. And I argue you got to be great about 2% of the time. Like in those key critical moments, those key decisive points, you got to be great. You know, when you've got the ball or you've got a key block or right, that's when you've got to be great. All the other time you can be innovating and failing and learning, or innovating and it works and learning. And the important piece is, for me, especially as a father and a partner, you know, I tell both my wife and my kids all the time, like, I'll handle something and then I'll go back and I'll be like, you know, I was thinking about it. That wasn't the best way to do it. Let me reset here and talk about this. Or just acknowledge, like, hey, maybe that advice wasn't the best advice at the time. And I think that it's not, the goal for me is not, like, as I'm thinking about it here, I'd love to say I'm trying to operate at the highest performance I can. And the truth is, I am trying to grow into a better performing individual at all things, all the time, right? In each moment. And sometimes I get it and sometimes I don't. And the truth is, there is such a thing as good enough on certain things. And most of life, you just got to be good enough. Like, you know, I mean, think about the military. I mean, like 80% of it is showing up, right? If you show up, you're ahead of 80%. Right. So now now you try a little bit and you're performing a little bit better. And so I think that, you know, for me, it's about not how am I performing, but how am I growing? Right. I don't want to be, because greatness isn't static, right? If you take the 1972 Dolphins and you put them in a time capsule, and then I open the time capsule up right now, guess what? They get crushed by like Alabama or LSU. Like, they would get crushed. Greatness isn't static. So no matter how good a husband or father I think I am today, like that's, you don't get to just sit back on the laurels. You've got to continue to innovate and improve and keep going. And as a father, you know, my kids are older, youngest and my stepdaughter is 18 and the oldest, my daughter is 28. You know, now I'm just trying to figure out less how to be a good father and how to be a good teammate. Like you're all adults now. How am I helping you to become the best person you could be? That you want to be, as opposed to who I think you need to be. And, you know, the foundation is important. And then the experience is essential. So they're experiencing life and, you know, having the will to see a person going down the wrong path or a path that you think might be wrong and not, okay, when do I step in? When do I say something, right? If your buddy, you know, is dating somebody who you don't approve of, you know, when do you say that, right? You know, or you think they're drinking too much, you know, when do you step in? And so now, you know, for me as, you know, as a parent, I think I'm always trying like, how am I a good teammate? How am I giving them resources or perspective? As opposed to providing my experience, which is wholly different than their experience. And as a partner, I'll tell you, you know, you've talked about humility before and loyalty. And I always talk about, you talked about humility and empathy. And those are two of my big four. The other two are curiosity and loyalty. And with my wife, I just ask a lot of questions. Like, hey, what are you thinking right now? How do you feel about that? Like, hey, what if this happened? How do you feel about that? What do you think? Or, hey, you know, if I perceive displeasure or whatever, I go, hey, I want to make sure I understand, like, you seem upset. Did I get that right? Okay. If I got that right, can you explain to me why you're upset? And I think it's about, and then being responsive. To, okay, I didn't see it that way. Or, okay, well, I disagree, but what would make you feel better? Like, how can this be handled? Like, you know, I think, you know, we think we fall in love and then everything is like roses and rainbows. And, you know, I think, you know, when people say, you know, relationships are work, I don't think that's a bad thing to say. I think we put it in a bad space. It is work. You have to work at it. You have to put, you know, dedicated effort into any relationship, but you should also want to. Like it's not work that I go, oh God, I got to do this. No, it's like, oh my gosh, I really want in whatever relationship, whether it's my children or my wife or my teammates, I really, it matters. And I want to get it right. And so it is work. And it's work that I want. I want that work.
Yeah, that's a big piece of it for sure is, you know, that relationship. And you got to pour into that just like you would anything, whether it's, you know, what you're doing in work, it's in being able to balance that and deal with their reactions to sometimes. I think a lot of times is if you don't get the reaction that you perceived in your head was supposed to happen, that completely, you know, it'll completely throw us off.
The disorienting dilemma. And we go, wait, now what's going on? This doesn't make sense. And we tend to have a negative reaction to the world not making sense as opposed to being curious and going, wait, why didn't that happen? I believe this person makes good sense. So something, they either have a piece of information that I need or I have a piece of information that they need.
Yep. That curiosity piece, that is a huge piece and something that, you know, it's easily lost on us. And I know we were talking beforehand as well, JC, and I, like I said, I've referenced it in some of our other episodes, is talking about purpose. For transitioning service members, I know, and as an athlete too, I think it's, you know, they're very, and I know you've done work in this field with, you know, merging vets and players, because it's, I think it's a very similar experience, and having experienced them both is like, that's everything. Everything you do is in that purpose, you know, and when that's taken away from you and when you move on to that, you know, it can lead you down, you know, it can lead you down a dark path, or it can, you know, send you into, you know, the throes of depression. But you have a great perspective on this, and I'd love you to share about that, about how we go about purpose and how, you know, how we should look into this.
Yeah, it's interesting. Whenever, you know, I'm going to put athletes and the military in the same boat here. When we leave our sport or we leave our service, overnight we lose our identity, our purpose, and our community. And that happens overnight. And I sit there and I go, how is that not considered a trauma? Like, that is an absolute human trauma. And we don't talk about it like that. And I think that's a disservice to it. But purpose is really interesting because, and I think, you know, I think society has gone so far as to be like, you got to find your purpose, hunt your purpose, you know, you got to find it. I hate that, because if all that time you're searching for this purpose is time you're not living, right? And you may never find what, you know, this grandiose purpose, right? We think this, it's like, you know, feed the homeless or whatever that grandiose thing is, because, you know, we're all stars in our movie of life, and that's fair. But for me, what I got to a point, and it's work, right, is I find purpose in every single moment. My purpose, you know, I say my purpose is now. Right. So now it's talking with you and the audience. You know, tonight I'll talk to my kids, and you know, my purpose will be to be present and, you know, talking to them, or my wife, or, you know, we're in a workshop now. So in Seattle here, and my purpose will be whatever I have to do then. And I think that if we live a life of a bunch of purposes day to day, hour to hour, minute to minute, then when we look back at our life, how can we say anything other than we lived a life of purpose, right? I mean, people are like, oh, your purpose is to help, you know, veterans and spouses, you know, transition. No, that's not my purpose. That's what I do sometimes. And sometimes that's my purpose. And sometimes my purpose is, you know, being a student. And sometimes my purpose is being a friend. And it changes from moment to moment. And it has to. And that works for me. You know, I think you can, your purpose doesn't have to be all consuming like it was in the military or in sports, which is pretty all consuming. Your purpose can be in every moment, in every single day.
I love that. And it's something that, because everybody wants to have that purpose. And it's like, this is the reason that you've heard the quote, I'm sure, that the two most important days in your life are the day you're born and the day you find out why. Yeah. But, you know, that why can definitely go into, you know, what you're doing every day, like finding purpose in each moment and those important moments and building relationships and being at your work, being there for your teammates. Man, there's so much that goes into that. And I love that. Something that we always, you know, that we talk about on this episode and going into the vulnerability aspect is, you know, talking about kind of your darkest day or moment or season, whatever it may be. And, you know, what was going through your head at that time? 'Cause, you know, we talked about everybody, you know, there's people out there living your story, how you navigated through that and, you know, your thoughts at the times and maybe the myths that you told yourself, that kept you there and kind of how you got on the other side of that.
Yeah. So it was, you know, I had four suicide attempts, and I will tell you that in each one of them, I thought I was solving a problem. I thought the problem was me. I was the problem. I wasn't controlling my emotions. I wasn't a good person. I couldn't assimilate to something that I was unfamiliar with. You know, two were in uniform and two were after uniform. But for me, it was, I took the full accountability and said, I'm the problem. And what do? You solve the problem. And the problem is me. And that was, you know, and it was, and there was a certain amount, it wasn't a certain amount. There was a lot of ego in that. Right. I mean, and not looking at this as a holistic issue and what was, you know, and not reflecting and not doing a bunch of the other stuff I should have been doing, but I didn't know who I was. I didn't know what I was supposed to be doing. I ran away from the gun club because I wanted to prove that I could be successful outside of the gun club. And yeah, that was probably the darkest times in my life. And what got me out of it was unconditional support and having a community and certainly my wife, Jen, who, you know, was able to provide a perspective that, you know, I was blind to, was able to, you know, not just give me kind of the consoling support, but also the, hey, you know, get out of your own headspace a little bit, you know, dumbass. And I don't want to say it was tough love. It was love. It was, hey, let's look at this. Let's reorient our perspective a little bit. And I'll tell you that, you know, I've read a lot recently, and and everything I read, you know, a little confirmation bias for me, it convinces me more that we are all interconnected, right? When we look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, what I think what we missed at the very base was not safety, but community. And recognizing that we're all interrelated, we're all connected in this, in some way. I mean, heck, we share 99.9% of our DNA. And yet we want to create these factions, right? I'm a vet. You know, you're a civilian. I'm black. You're white. You know, I'm male. You're female. As opposed to what's our interrelation with each other, and how are we connected? And that connection, I think, is essential. Whether it's with one person, though, you know, I would argue that, you know, real. What makes us special or unique, you know? And again, I think this is very, there was a period of time, and it might've been in the millennial your generation, or maybe it's the younger generation. Everybody wants to be special and unique. Well, you're different. Everybody's different because of the 0.01% of DNA that's different. But if I put you in this box that I'm sitting in now, and then I switch you out with somebody else, it's just a different person. What makes you unique or special is how you interact with your ecosystem. How do you interact with those around you? What's your connection, right? So I was reading this book called Web of Life by a guy named Capra. And he talks about, you know, white blood cells. A white blood cell is very, can we agree that a white blood cell is a special blood cell, right? It fights infection. It does some really cool things. It has cognition and it knows what it's supposed to do and it knows what it's not supposed to do, right? White blood cells that attack things that are good, those are bad blood cells. Like, that's not a good thing. We love the white blood cell because of what it does, how it interacts within the ecosystem. If it just sat there and was like every other cell, it wouldn't be special. It'd just be a different cell. And I really like that analogy of having that cognition of knowing how am I supposed to interact with my society, with my community, with my ecosystem. And I think that that's really important. So I think that, you know, getting out from a dark place helped somebody else. It wasn't just me. And when I look at the hard times, and when I look at the easy times, I was never alone. It was always part of a larger ecosystem, whether that was one person or hundreds of other people. And we don't give enough thought to that. And there's got to be a balance between the personal accountability of owning your own stuff and taking accountability for where you're wrong. And also being able to operate within the community and recognize that you can't exist without it, which is harder the older I get, because the more alone I want to be.
Yeah, no, that's for sure. Well, JC, first off, brother, thank you for sharing that and diving into it, because, you know, it's going right into the vulnerability we're talking about. Stuff to share like that is not easy. And, you know, it's hard for us to, you know, to realize, you know, you said like some of this time took place while you're in uniform. And, you know, people look at like leaders are invincible. You know, they're kind of untouchable. They don't experience these things. Like they don't have these hardships because they have all the answers and they figured it out. And, man, is that such a, that's such a lie. Cause you know, everybody does go through their, they have their own trauma, and trauma is trauma. Like we talked about earlier, you know, so I like to say like the analogy, like, you know, everybody has their own giants. It might not be Goliath or it might not be the one you're facing, but it is to them.
Yeah.
And, you know, to how you do that, and you talked about it, man, it's having that tribe around you, those people. And sometimes they give you a tough love, which is love too. It's at the end of the day, the commonality in it is it's love, no matter what adjective you put in front of it. And it's what you need. And, you know, you get to a place where, you know, you think, you know, you're the problem and there's the only one solution behind it. But, you know, there's a lot of other people that depend on you too. And sometimes our ego gets in the way of that. The ego is a crazy thing. I mean, there's tons of books, you know, what's the famous one, Ego is the Enemy, the Ryan Holiday.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I had a close friend of mine that, you know, we talked about, we were both going through some similar things at the time, and he hit me with that, and I was throwing the blame game out, and, you know, oh, but you know, they, this, that. And he's like, dude, that's all you. He's like, that's your ego talking. Like, you got to figure out how to eliminate that. And it's not easy. It's extremely hard to do. And it requires immense humility and lifelong learning. And being able to look at things from different perspectives, for sure. But, you know, it's very powerful. So thank you very much for sharing that, brother. And then, so I know I've kept you here for you know, over an hour, and I appreciate it. But if you could tell the audience kind of what you're working on now, because we talked about it a little bit, but where you guys are at right now and what you're getting into.
Yeah. So the Commit Foundation helps high potential individuals design their life. It empowers them to design their life. We don't give anything. We invest in their future with an expectation that the return on investment will be that they will make impact in the country and the nation. And, you know, we focus primarily on identity, purpose, and community, the three things that we've been talking about the most. But it's really about, you know, we see transition happens, right? And I talk about this a lot. Like, I got this can. It was full and now it's empty. And it went through a transition, but still a can, right? If I want to make this can into a Tesla, it needs to go through a transformation. And my argument is that military transition theory and military to civilian transition is not enough. It's part of the puzzle, right? I mean, there's the systemic pieces where, like, how do I get my VA and how do I get my disability and how do I get my retirement, or how do I, you know, how do I prepare for a job, or and all that kind of stuff. But we're asking people to really make a transformation, and transformation takes reflection, and it takes some space to reflect on, you know, what am I bringing forward? What do I want to leave behind? You know, what do I want my life to look like? The people that we serve, they'll have no problem getting a job. Okay. You can get, anybody can walk out today and get a job. I want you to find a career. I want you to have a life that matters to you. And we provide that space and invest in these folks through, you know, our asynchronous pursue your purpose learning, which helps you figure out what's important to you. Then we have some internal coaching. Then we invest in some external coaching with ICF, you know, International Coaching Federation, executive coaches, very high level coaches. And then we, you know, one of the hardest things for me over a decade is building a community, a network, because you get out of the military and you don't know anybody. And so we have a very well-established and high-performing and high-potential network that we bring you into and introduce you to, so that you're not starting at zero. You're, you know, we it's almost like, hey, we get you this super platform in the military, and then we push you out and say, hey, do great things, and you start back down here. Well, okay, why wouldn't we set these people up for success so they can continue an upward trajectory? And I'm not saying there won't be dips. I'm saying that the trajectory stays the same, that you're not starting at zero. And you're doing more than saying, well, I show up on time and I work hard. Okay. That's every good employee does that. What makes you special? And so I think, you know, I'm very, very honored and humbled to be on this team, and, you know, I love that we serve who we serve. I love that we have a spouse. You know, we've now allowed spouses into the fellowship, members of the intelligence community and members of the Five Eyes, our Five Eye allies. And, you know, I'm looking to continue to grow, because I think what we bring is that transformational experience to provide that holding space for people to actually do that transformation. And there's no set path. Like, people, everybody's at a different level. It's very individualized. But it's so essential to ensuring that, you know, our veterans are having the same success that they've experienced before. You know, when I look at the stats, while our unemployment numbers aren't low, our underemployment numbers are the highest of any demographic at 33%. That's a problem to me. And that's why, you know, 90% of veterans leave their first position after 18 months. They're being pushed out in the world without this transformational experience. And I think we have to provide the resources. Transformation is up to the individual, but we have to provide the space and the resources to allow that to happen.
I love that. And, you know, I'm, like I stated earlier, just very thankful as well. You have some amazing people in the tribe there, in that community, and you're doing some amazing work. And additionally, too, I know that you're, you know, you do a lot of writing as well. How can people, you know, seek out and you know, to look more into some of the stuff you've published out there? Because I feel like they'd, you know, a lot of people could benefit from reading a lot of the stuff that you have out there.
Well, thank you. Most of my stuff is published in the Epoch Times or the Havoc Journal. You know, if they connect with me on LinkedIn, that's really the best way, because I share everything, you know, on LinkedIn. You know, I encourage people, if they have a question or they want a perspective or they'd like me to write about something, reach out to me, you know, through Instagram, through LinkedIn, and just ask a question. So thank you.
Awesome. No, for sure. Well, brother, I know you got a lot going on. I appreciate you, you know, giving us this time, to talk about some amazing things and things that we've, you know, we've all dealt with, but, just thank you again. And I'm excited for this to come out and for people to get to hear you, and get to know you how we know you. So thank you very much, brother. And before we get off, if you have any closing comments or anything, you know, to give.
You know, I came on this podcast because, Gavin, I met you and then I met your team, and I see you guys doing great things and wanting to continue to have impact after service, and that means the world to me. So the only thing I'll leave you with is I think I need a t-shirt.
Well, we can definitely make that happen.
So, for sure. continue to do the great stuff that you guys are doing. The message is right. The people are right. I'm very fortunate to know y'all.
Absolutely, brother. Well, thank you very much. Look forward to the release of this.
Me too.